who were shocked by this speech 3 days before he received the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo. He stopped in London. He gave one major address that was recorded and there are copies of. But then the next day, he included this next speech, and almost no one kept a copy except for the Pacifica Radio Archive. And they didn't even realize they had this copy of this speech until Brian DeShazer was on his belly in the Pacifica Radio Archive looking for something completely different. And he saw. At the bottom of the spine of a box, it said King, 65. Now, this is a speech from 64, but it was just mislabeled. And he thought, okay, we'll just take a look at it. And he and Mark Torres put it on a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and it sounded like a chipmunk. All speed it up. The tragedies of our day has been covering wars for the last 20 years from Brussels, Belgium, came in for one day and came to Democracy Now. He goes back tomorrow. He's in Lesbos. 100 boats a day are coming in. 5,000 people. City in the shadow of the Empire State Building, watch. You want to bring your partner, a daughter, a son, a mother, a father, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, and we become old friends fast. We break bread together. We toast the Pacifica Radio Archive. It's a $2,000 tax deductible charitable contribution that goes directly. To the Pacifica Radio Archive. You don't have to know when you can do it. Just pledge and we'll get in touch with you. Whether you pledge that $2,000 or $100 for the Martin Luther King Special Collection, the amazing speeches of Dr. King from 1957 on the power of peaceful persuasion to 61, the future of integration, to 62, the dimensions of a complete life, to 63, we want to be free, to 1964, this amazing speech that Dr. King gave in London. 67, the casualties of war in Vietnam. 67, the civil rights movement and its goals for the future. We urge you to call 1-800-735-0230. Make the call that makes it possible for the Pacifica Radio Archive to continue. We ask you to call. We ask you to stand up for independent media. Your call makes the difference. That number again, 1-800-735-0230. Please call. Brian DeShazer, I believe, since I'm in New York in the studios of Democracy Now!, is in the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much. You know, in listening to that Dr. King speech from 1964, also with a pledge of $100 or more, you'll get Studs Terkel interviewing Dr. King right after he came back by the bedside of Mahalia Jackson. And what an exciting, so we had that trajectory, him in London and then right back to the United States with Studs Terkel. 1-800-735-0230. You can also donate online at supportpra.org, where you can see a full list of the details of all the gifts we have for this holiday season. Amy Goodman, we really appreciate you bringing us the breaking news and connecting with history and understanding the context of Dr. King during these times of war. Thank you so much. 1-800-735-0230.
1-800-735-0230. Make the call that makes it possible for the Pacifica Radio Archive to continue. And remember, if you missed any part of today's broadcast, go to democracynow.org. This interview with Peter Bookart, who has been documenting war and now refugees, the crisis, the global crisis we have as 27 state governors in the United States, from Alabama to Texas, all over the country are saying no to refugees. Refugees fleeing from the wars that we started. We urge you to call 1-800-735-0230 and hear our excerpt in Paris. When we talked to one of the leading climate activists about what will protests look like in the wake of the Paris attacks? Will they be able to negotiate with the government of France to allow mass marches on this crisis of our time? Climate change, also the 21st century threat to the globe, to the planet. We urge you to call 1-800-735-0230. If you appreciated hearing Barbara Lee on everything from refugees to war, the one woman who stood alone 3 days after the September 11th attack saying no to war, that war is not the answer, saying we must repeal now the authorization for the use of military force. And what that means, hearing her voice speaking for herself. If you appreciate that, call the Pacifica Radio Archive and let us know that you care about history and context. We played during our interview with Barbara Lee her speech 14 years ago. History matters. We cannot let it be erased. 1-800-735-0230. That's why the Pacifica Radio Archive, the goldmine of the history of the movements of this country for the last half a century and beyond, it is so critical to preserve. Make your pledge, whether you pledge $25 or $50, $100 gets you the Martin Luther King Special Collection, including the lost tape of Dr. Martin Luther King 3 days before winning the Nobel Peace Prize. 1-800-4-3—the number to call is 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230, or the 90-hour USB jump drive collection. That's right, the 90-hour 4-gigabyte USB drive that includes so many of the speeches and conversations and programs from the Pacifica Radio Vault from stations across this country. The words of history. 1-800-735-0230. That jump drive is yours. That USB 90-hour 4-gigabyte USB drive is yours for a $300 contribution. We have less than a minute to go. We ask you to call 1-800-735-0230. Again, if you want to get the Martin Luther King collection on MP3 CD, it's yours for $100. Get a bunch, make that all your holiday gifts, and keep the Pacifica Radio Archive open for all by making that pledge right now. And if you want to come to New York, I'd love to host you. We don't have to work out the details here, but you got to make the reservation within this minute. And that is for dinner and a show, not a particular date, in New York. Watch the broadcast live of Democracy Now! And then I host you and whoever you choose for dinner. Maybe you want to celebrate the holidays, a birthday, a graduation anniversary, and that $2,000 goes to the archive. Please call 1-800-735-0230. Back to you, Brian.
Thank you, Amy. Yeah, we're wrapping up the show and really appreciate all those calls. And for $500, you can also get every digital downloads of everything, including today's Democracy Now!, which will include if you call. The phones are full, Amy.
Ooh, everything is gone. All right. You're listening to the 14th Annual Pacifica Radio Archives History for the Holidays Fun Drive broadcast, heard in a rare Pacifica simulcast on all five Pacifica stations. KPFA 94.1 FM Berkeley, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM North San Diego, 99.5 FM Ridgecrest, KPFT 90.1 Houston, Texas, WBAI 99.5 FM New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM Washington, D.C. Your donation today helps us rescue our history before it's lost. For a donation of $50, we'll send you, as our gift, our brand new Music for the Holidays benefit album, a compilation of 10 holiday songs donated by artists including Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Jackson Browne, Holly Near, Perla Bataya, Louise Goffin, Gabby Moreno, Elvis, David Garza, Leftover Cuties, The New Recessionaires, Quetzal, Nancy Sanchez, and more. Call 1-800-735-0230 to pledge your support for this endangered American treasure, or go online at supportpra.org.
Welcome back. It's the Pacifica Radio Archives History for the Holidays Fun Drive broadcast. I'm John Wiener, anchoring this hour on the Pacifica Radio Network. And joining me here in the KPFK studios in Los Angeles is Mark Torres of the Pacifica Archives. Mark, thank you for coming in today.
John, it's a pleasure to be on your show each and every time.
Well, coming up in this hour, we're going to be playing some wonderful stuff from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Classic interviews with Dustin Hoffman, Kurt Vonnegut, and John Coltrane.
Wow.
These people are gods in our world. And the archives feature some unique interviews with them. The idea here is to inspire you to support the Pacifica Radio Archives in their project of digitizing the thousands of reel-to-reel tapes, which are upstairs here in our building in North Hollywood, California. We're asking you to call and pledge a contribution this hour to keep this indispensable and irreplaceable institution of ours alive and well for the coming season. The number, 800-735-0230. The Pacifica Radio Archives, it's our history. It's the record of our lives. It's the sound of our struggles and our dreams. And it's the voices of our heroes. Nobody does it better. Nobody does it with greater care or greater professionalism than the Pacifica Archives staff. They work tirelessly here in L.A., headed by Brian DeShazer. I see them every week. I know it's true. 800-735-0230. Pledge $50, pledge $100, pledge $250, but call us now. So this hour, we're going to be talking about a special new project which takes interviews from the Pacifica Radio Archives and animates them for a new generation of people. This is the work of a group called Blank on Blank, and now we want to talk to our special guest, the creator of Blank on Blank animated interview series, David Gerlach. David, welcome to the airwaves.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. We're very happy to have you here, and I know Mark Torres feels the same way.
Hi, David. How are you?
Hi, Mark. Good to talk to you.
All right.
So just before, we want to listen to we want to start with the John Coltrane interview that you've done some fantastic animation with. But tell us a little bit about this project, how you came to it. Are you an animator? Are you a radio archivist? Where do you fit into the picture?
You know, remarkably, I'm neither, but now I'm kind of an archivist slash lover of great animation. I'm a journalist by trade. I used to actually started in print here in New York in the early 2000s. And like most journalists, I would record the interviews I did for stories. I was writing here in the city for magazines, and then I was at Newsweek. All my friends would do the same. We'd go out, have drinks. Someone would say, oh, you should have heard what I got on tape last night. And we'd all, you know, cheers and chuckle. And no one would ever get to hear that tape because, you know, they file their story, put a few quotes in, and they stash the tape or the file on their hard drive or the mini disc, whatever. And it always stuck with me that this was, you know, American history, this journalistic gold that no one ever got to hear. And I felt like there was some way to kind of bring it to life. And that idea kind of stuck with me as I went into working in television. I was at MSNBC and helped launch the Rachel Maddow Show, and then at ABC News. And I watched this proliferation of YouTube videos and cell phone videos were bombarding the airwaves. And I realized that even if, for lack of a better term, the quality wasn't pristine, if it was crap, you know, that it was the shaky video, if it was something good, people would be engaged with it. So it made me think that even if someone had to use a microcassette recorder to sit down with someone, they use their phone, what have you, if it wasn't recorded in a professional environment, it still could resonate. So I kind of put all those pieces together. And a few years ago, I left ABC, did a podcast with the Public Radio Exchange, and started playing around with some video because I knew we could really bring this stuff to life as animated shorts, and got the attention of some great folks at PBS Digital Studios. They said, "You want to do a series?" And it's been 3 years now, and we're about to hit 50 episodes with Mike on Blank.
And how did you? Where did you? What was your meeting ground with the Pacifica Radio Archives?
That was, you know, I'm always kind of, you know, looking around for interviews, and, you know, I actually coincidentally live a few blocks away from BAI here in Brooklyn. So obviously I knew the station, and somehow I came across the archives and just, you know, it was one of those aha moments and realized there was this just amazing collection of content that I felt like with us, we can help bring it to a broader audience. I think one of the things I really love doing is, you know, it's one thing to first digitize material, and it's the next thing to, you know, get it onto a website. And what the next step we can take is help people realize that this great, you know, cultural history is there. So I got to talking with Brian and some of the great team over there and said, you know, I think this Coltrane episode interview would be awesome. You know, who ever got to hear John Coltrane driving someone around suburban Long Island, you know, one afternoon in the mid-1960s. And I just felt like this is really special stuff that not enough people have discovered. And Brian was just ecstatic about it. And he is, and his team have been instrumental in preserving this stuff and realizing that if it isn't digitized, if it isn't saved from analog, it'll disappear forever. So it's it was just a great opportunity to come together with Pacifica.
Well, we want to listen to this John Coltrane interview, but Mark Torres, set this up a little bit. How did this come to be, and what are we going to hear?
Okay, well, one of the Pacifica journalists, Frank Kofsky, has, you know, first of all, I guess we'll have to say, I actually did one of the last interviews with Alice Coltrane and learned that John Coltrane was a very solitary person. He did not do very many interviews. This is really the most extensive interview there is, and it was done because one of Pacifica's reporters, Frank Kofsky, just, you know, was at the right place at the right time, and he caught John at a point where he made him comfortable enough to do an extensive interview over 40 minutes long. So this is what we have here. It's one of the only extensive interviews that John Coltrane ever did. It covers a wide range of topics, from changing his mouthpiece, which made him go from tenor to soprano saxophone, to attending a Malcolm X meeting. So many different topics from one of the world's greatest creative geniuses of our time.
It's recorded in 1966 on Long Island. Frank Kofsky took the train out to interview Coltrane. Coltrane picked him up at the station. They drove around town. They stopped to talk. Let's listen now to about 5 minutes.
Do you live far outside of wherever we are now?
Well, I guess I'm about 4 or 5 miles down the road.
You really sound like Farmer John.
Yeah, man, when I come up here and I have to get everything I'm going to get, I got to go to the store and do all that because I don't want to come back up here.
Mm-hmm.
garage out there that I'm getting fixed now. I think it's going to be my practice room. You know, sometimes you fill a room and it ends up you ain't still going to the toilet. So I don't know. I hope I like it, but I keep a horn on the piano, and I have a horn in my bedroom. My flute's usually back there, because when I go there, I'm tired, so I lay down and practice.
About how many hours a day do you play, would you say?
Not too much at this time. I find that it's only when something is trying to come through, you know, mm-hmm. but I really practice, and then it's I don't know how many hours, it's all day. I did a foolish thing. I got dissatisfied with my mouthpiece. And I had some work done on this thing, and instead of making it better, it ruined it. And it really discouraged me, you know, a little bit, because there were certain aspects of that, of playing that certain fast thing that I was reaching for that I couldn't push because I had damaged this thing. So I just had to curtail it. But at that moment, it was so vivid in my mind, the difference of what I was getting on the horn. As soon as I put that horn in my mouth, I could hear. I could feel it, you know. So I just stopped. I just went into other things. And in fact, the problem is one of the reasons I started getting dissatisfied with that tenor mouthpiece, see? Because the sound of that soprano was actually so much closer to me in my ear. And I didn't want to admit this damn thing, because I said, well, the tenor is my horn. This is my favorite. But soprano, there's still something there in just the voice of it. And I can't, it's really beautiful.
Awesome.
I really like
I was staying with have a friend, a young lady, and she was downtown at one of Malcolm X's speeches, and lo and behold, who should plop down in the seat next to her but John Coltrane?
Yeah.
Were you impressed with him?
Definitely. Dude, I felt I had to see the man. I was quite impressed.
Some musicians have said that there's a relationship between some of Malcolm's ideas and the music.
Well, I think that music, being an expression of the human heart or of the human being, does express just what is happening. The whole of a human experience is at a particular time that is being expressed. In any situation that we find in our lives, when there's something that we feel should be better, we must exert effort to try to make it better.
And
so it's the same socially, musically, politically, in any department of your life. I think music is an instrument that can create the initial better thought pattern, better change, you see, and the thinking of the people. I feel I want to be a force for good. You know, I want to be a force for real good. In other words, I know that there are bad forces. You know, I know that there are forces out here which bring suffering to others and misery to the world. But I want to be the opposite force. I want to be a force which is truly for good.
What were you looking for, John? You want some cigarettes?
No, I'm just sitting up because my bag is wet and I'm just trying to get off the
phone. I don't have any more of my prepared questions to ask you or my improvised questions to ask you. I don't know when I'll ever get a chance to sit you down with a tape recorder. Do you have anything else that you'd like to get on here?
I think, man, we just about covered it, I believe. Just about covered it.
John Coltrane recorded in 1966, speaking with Frank Kofsky, stopping to talk by the side of the road near his house in Long Island. Coltrane died less than a year later. Rare audio from the Pacifica Radio Archives. I'm John Wiener. I'm speaking with Mark Torres of the Archives and David Gerlach of Blank on Blank, which animated this interview. Mark, you've heard this before. What do you think about when you hear this little five-minute cut?
Well, what I think is, Dave Gerlach, you really nailed it. I mean, there was a lot of audio to choose from. And how did you go about, you know, taking a listen to this entire interview and selecting just these clips, because they were woven together really wonderfully?
Well, you know, I mean, part of it just by the nature of the budget of, you know, what we can animate, you know, we have to keep them around 4 minutes. But I also feel like it just gives you this fly on the wall kind of moment to just get to hear someone you normally don't get to hear. And then, you know, you can go discover this whole conversation. And what kind of struck me was really simple stuff, like him mentioning he built this huge studio at his house, but he sometimes finds himself still going to practice in the bathroom, which I just thought was amazing. Just that the creative genius, and I kind of envisioned him when he was still in the city and, you know, making his way up the ladder. And I just kind of, we always just like to give a picture of the individual and things you normally, you know, never got to hear, and on the life's ups and downs, and just the normal facets of life, his experiences. You know, I liked, even though he didn't say much about Malcolm X, I loved the idea. It was simple and to the point that he said, I figured I had to go see the man.
Yeah.
And it just was, pieces like that, I just feel like can just resonate. And we just try to think of something that can just present a picture of someone. And sometimes it's just their musings on a number of subjects. Sometimes it's, you know, one continuous kind of thought. But in this one, you know, we titled it John Coltrane on Giant Steps. And a few people commented, oh, I thought he was going to talk about giant steps. But I saw it as he was talking about giant steps for himself. He was taking the step. He was going to hear what Malcolm X was saying, the thing about how music was connected with social movements. He was talking about the steps he was taking from when he changed his mouthpiece. So it was a little kind of a play on words. And a few commenters were like, where the hell is giant steps? But you know, there's a reason, you know, we kind of named it that way.
So, Mark Torres, this is 5 minutes of an interview from the Pacifica Radio Archives. There's more of this, which our listeners can get a hold of.
Yes, they can. In this national broadcast, we hope you're enjoying the sound bites that we've selected for this segment. You can take away any of the sound that you're listening to, whether it's John Coltrane, Dustin Hoffman, Kurt Vonnegut, or any recorded program in our archive. For a $100 donation, we have a program voucher pack. If you call 1-800-735-0230. You can take away this pack. It makes a great gift for the holidays. You get not only a voucher, which you can redeem for any program in the archive, including any of the programs you're hearing in this segment. We'll also give you a brand new Music for the Holidays original music CD with a lot of help from our musical friends like Jackson Brown, Louise Goffin, Quetzal, Gabby Moreno, Holly Near. So many great artists, 11 artists in total, have donated songs for this project. They've all performed on Pacifica Radio, and they believe in what we do in digitizing, preserving, restoring, and making accessible these great recordings. $100 donation, 1-800-735-0230.
800-735-0230. We want to move on to hear a little more of the Blank on Blank animated interview series, drawing on material from the Pacifica Radio Archives and making it available to a broader audience. Let's do Dustin Hoffman here. David Gerlach, before we let you go, tell us about this Dustin Hoffman clip. How did you pick this one?
You know, I love this one because, you know, there's something about interviews in this from another era where I guess they're a lot less guarded. You could tell there wasn't a handler sitting there. He just was riffing about his life. I mean, he talked about having a switchblade taped to his leg, even though he never used it when he grew up. And he was kind of in this moment when he was kind of starting a family and he was in his 30s, but there was this movement of the late 60s happening, and the graduate had happened, and it just struck me as fascinating. He's talking about this pivotal moment in American history, and it was just so happens that it was this actor you know, he was Ratso Rizzo, you know, and I loved it. I just loved the recording. It was so personal. It was so thoughtful about ideas of growing up and manhood that resonate today. And that's one of the things we always try to do is these voices from the past can connect us to the future because of things people go through and they're talking about. Usually, you know, history repeats itself, and the interview's just awesome. Just loved it.
Well, David Gerlach, you did have him in this clip after Midnight Cowboy, which was a great movie, but you had also the choice in the Pacifica Radio Archives of Dustin Hoffman on the set of The Graduate in 1967. Ooh. How did you go about choosing between the two?
Well, you know, it was tough because I think that's also you have Mike Nichol.
That's true.
Bunch of, the cast. In the end, it was a few years removed from that. I was torn because obviously at The Graduate, he had just, as he mentions in this interview that we chose, he didn't know where he was going with his career. He thought he was going to be moving towards a life on Broadway in New York, and he got plucked out of that and got this role in The Graduate and changed his life forever. But what I liked a few years later was he was kind of at this pivotal point where he was, there's a great part of this interview when he says, you know, people talk to me like I've been around forever, like I'm in this old hand or whatever, like I'm 32 or whatever. But it's just interesting how you can fall into that place when you arrive where I guess you were supposed to be. It seems like you've been there all along.
Well, David Gerlach, I know we have to let you go now. David Gerlach is the creator of the Blank on Blank animated interview series, which draws on rare audio from the Pacifica Radio Archives. It's great stuff. We're so happy you were able to find it. We're so happy the Pacifica Radio Archives work with you on this. And we thank you for talking with us today on the Pacifica Radio Archives History for the Holidays Fund Drive.
No, thank you. And I just want to say to all the listeners that the support that you can give to the Radio Archives is so important because the work they're doing preserving this remarkable American history, it can't happen without you. I mean, this history will be lost if it's not digitized and preserved and allow people like us at Blank on Blank to bring it to life in new formats and for all the other, you know, artists and journalists and musicians, researchers out there. You know, this is American history and you can preserve it. So please support these efforts. And the website is support.pra.org. PRA.org's website.
And Dave, we're looking forward to your next selection from the Pacifica Radio Archives. We can't wait to see what you find next time.
We're gonna put our coal mining hat on and take a look and see what's in there.
David Gerlach, creator of the Blank on Blank animated interview series. We want to listen to the Dustin Hoffman interview that was selected for the Blank on Blank animated interview series. But we want to remind you, this is the Pacifica Radio Archives History for the Holidays Fun Drive broadcast. I'm John Wiener in Los Angeles with Mark Torres of the Archives. And we're asking you to call us now, 800-735-0230, 800-735-0230. Pledge your support to keep this irreplaceable, indispensable resource of our history, our movement, our heroes, alive and well in the coming season. Let's listen now to Dustin Hoffman. This is taped in 1971.
A man's thoughts, a man's feelings are kind of what seem to be the attractive thing, not somebody's face or somebody's famosity, you know, just the fact that someone is famous isn't a thing to be adored. The people that come up and grab you and touch you and the people that kind of go haywire are the people who have come from another time, from a time of myth, heroes, of movie stars. Like an ambivalence about being a star. Well, I'm a star, so I lead a double life being a star. In those kinds of times where you come out to support someone or you want to pay tribute, I'm aware that I'm a public display. It's like when the bombing took place next to the apartment in which my wife and children and I lived in, I upstaged the bombing, whether I liked it or not. I happened to run in and get a painting, and that was in all the papers. The fact that I lived next door seemed to be more important than the dynamics, really, of what had taken place. When I walk down the street today, I am molested least by young people. Youth itself is today more famous than anybody, than any single person. And there is a sense of self. They're their own movie star. I mean, it's sad that there are a whole bunch of people who are at an age now and will live a few years and die who did not experience any kind of sexual freedom outside of getting married and turning out the lights and making kids and talking dirty with their friends and have tremendous antipathy toward marijuana, which they think of as, gee, these kids are going out smoking and making love, and it's pure envy. I know that when I was an adolescent, it was a very, very painful time for me. And I had a lot of trouble in school. I had tremendous bouts with passivity. And had I been brought up today and been involved with marijuana or been smoking, it could be dangerous. People used to call them growing pains, but certain pains of emergence should be dealt with. I don't think you solve a problem by saying everybody turn on. I grew up on the coattails of an aggressive society. I carried a knife taped to my leg, never used it, but it was there, and thought of gang warfare as being really quite glamorous and exciting, and dragging your car next to another guy and evil-eyeing him and see who could evil-eye out the other one. And getting a girl was based upon how tough you were, not what an egghead you were. Kids on the street, if they recognize me or something, sometimes they say, hey, rats, or something like that. A lot of them have yelled the same thing, which is,
I'm walking here.
And that wasn't in the script. That was an accident. We were walking across the street, and a cab came by and threatened to ruin the shot. And at that moment, I was not Ratso, I was just myself trying to save the scene. But because I had been saying the lines with John Voight, I said it through the character. Now, maybe that's what acting's all about. I felt connected with the role. There was a side of myself that I had always felt a little bit like Ratso. I like to think that Ratso Rizzo lives, but he's a conglomeration of street life. He's a conglomeration of maybe several lonely people. He's lifted a little bit. There are traits in my own personal character which I don't feel are admirable, which I feel are unattractive. I've tried to bring out unattractive aspects of me in roles that I've played and sometimes achieved that. I can't apologize for anything I've done. I did as much as I could do at that time in my life with the part, as much as I knew about acting or about myself. I did. I tried as hard as I could, and I couldn't do better. We all defend ourselves against shock. We don't like to be shocked. I think if you walk into a room and someone scares you, you go through the shock, and then you very quickly try to put down the shock and say, oh boy, well, you scared me, you know, and you try to nullify its effect by becoming very rational. It's funny because when I'm reviewed now, I'm reviewed like I'm an old man. A reviewer that likes me will say I'm my usual admirable self. I get the feeling they're talking about, you know, some aging actor who's done dozens of films, and I've just been around 3 years, or I'm thought of as a veteran. I'm no longer a newcomer. I'm kind of establishment, I guess.
Dustin Hoffman recorded in 1971 from
great.
The Pacifica Radio Archives. This is the Pacifica Radio Archives History for the Holidays Fund Drive. The Dustin Hoffman, a 1971 interview from the archives, is one of the things we're featuring this hour. It's part of the Blank on Blank animated interview series. You know, when he says the bombing, he talks about at the beginning of that clip about the bombing that he lived next door to. That was the Weather Underground townhouse explosion in 1971. Mark Torres, you, while we were listening to this, you searched on your cell phone, and what did you show me?
Yeah, he referenced that he was carrying a painting down the street, and somebody took a picture, and that became the iconic moment instead of what the social circumstances were of the day. And there is the picture online where you could see him in front of his burning apartment, and with the exact painting he was referring to over his head. It's huge. It's like 6 feet tall. And he's slung it over his head, and he's running down the street with it.
Man, those were the days. 800-738-0230 is our number. We're asking you to call and support the Pacifica Radio Archives now. where interviews like this Dustin Hoffman one and hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands more are preserved, archived, and kept for the future. It's our history. It's our heroes. It's our lives. It's our struggles. It exists only because of support from our listeners. That's why we're asking you to call us now at 800-735-0230. We're joined now here in the KPFK studios by our program director, Alan Minsky. Alan, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for just being here, John, and the great show that you do, and Mark, the incredible work that you do up at the archives. Folks, we have a $10,000 matching pledge, and we've got to make it now between now and the end of this fund drive.
Where did
folks.
We? Where did we get?
I'm going to tell that.
Where?
Now,
right.
Yesterday in Southern California, I was at a great event with the founder of Salon.com, the author, best-selling author, David Talbot. And David, I introduced him, and David said, "Hey, I used to intern at KPFK." Hey. Well, the okay. person who's given us the $10,000 matching pledge is, of course, a former, I don't think they really call them interns then, volunteer at
programmer.
WBAI yeah. in New York City. Person, his name is Yoko Ono. And she has given a $10,000 matching pledge.
Wow.
And of course, by the way, one of Yoko and John's dear friends back in the 70s was a former KPFK programmer out here in Los Angeles, Elliot Mins.
Who we've had on the air here.
Right, and a dialogue that I had with him on John Lennon's 70th birthday as we celebrated that is up in the archives. But again, a $10,000 matching pledge, that means when you call in, let's say you pledge at the $50 level, because the past informs the future, there's the 2016 calendar of revolt, that's a $50 pledge, it's like giving $100. When you call
right.
and you get the voucher for $100 for any show, and that comes with a whole package of stuff. For the $100 pledge, you get the music for the holiday CD, you get the Holiday Stories MP3 compilation, plus a program voucher for any show you want from the archives. That's a $100 pledge. It's like giving $200 because of the matching pledge. $300 pledge, fantastic stuff. You get the Dustin Hoffman that we have here, and the John Coltrane, and the Kurt Vonnegut, and the Studs Terkel interviewing a gajillion people there,
That's
and
right.
Martin Luther King speeches. Tons of new material that they've uncovered this year. All of that, plus everything I mentioned before, plus a DVD of Patti Smith on Democracy Now!, that's $300. You pledge at that level, it's like giving $600.
That's right.
Because it's a matching pledge.
It's matching.
I'm very interested in this calendar thing. We have this year's Pacifica Radio Archives calendar of revolt. And I wanted to ask Mark Torres, just for example, what's on the calendar of revolt for
okay.
today, which is August 18th?
No, November 18th.
I mean, pardon me, November.
It's like
Are
Los
you
Angeles.
Kidding? It's not August anymore?
Yes,
oh, my God.
We had some cold days, but now it's back to being warm.
Okay.
November 18th.
Well,
what's on the calendar for November 18th?
Here's the deal. There is a separate historical entry that you will not find probably in a normal history book. For every day of the year, that's already incredible in and of itself, and the graphics are amazing. On today, November 18th, for the entry for the 2015 calendar, Susan B. Anthony was arrested for illegally voting for president in 1872.
Wow.
How many people know that?
And
great fact.
The future in
okay.
my hands,
2016.
The 2016 calendar of revolt.
Okay, what
and
do you got?
It is on November 18th. William Taft orders two U.S. warships to Nicaragua against President Zayala. That's in 1909.
Wow.
So, folks, you get the idea. If you have this year's calendar, you want to get next year's calendar. Different entries every day. Gabriel San Ramon, great work.
Okay, here's the thing about this, everybody. There were 100 calendars. It's limited edition. We only have 20 left. So let's get 20 people on the phone call right now for a $50 pledge, 1-800-735-0230, and take away this incredible calendar of revolt. It's not guaranteed that he's going to do it again next year. That takes a lot of work to put a separate entry for every year, every day of the year. So get to those phones and ask for the calendar of revolt for a $50 pledge.
800-735-0230. We've promised our listeners we're going to play the Kurt Vonnegut interview from the Pacifica Radio Archives. This was also featured in the Blank on Blank animated interview series. Kurt Vonnegut, of course, a total hero of ours, one of the great voices of the left from the starting in the 50s for the last 50 years. I know him not only for his unforgettable novels, but for his essays for The Nation magazine. He That's also right. turns out to have been a great talker.
Oh, my goodness. Kurt Vonnegut was a friend of Pacifica. Every time we had a chance, we would go and record Kurt, whether it was a talk that he was giving, a lecture, a reading. Kurt Vonnegut was a friend of ours for over 40 years, going back to the 1960s. So this clip that we're going to hear right now, please keep the phones ringing. If you're liking what you hear, there's an entire hour and a half with Kurt Vonnegut wow. that you can take away with our voucher pack. Just call up at 800-735-0230. There's a lot of wisdom with Kurt Vonnegut. He tells some of his secrets of writing, which I kind of want to know. Hey, he's such a prolific writer. And he's
I want to
really
know the
amazing.
Secrets of writing, too. Let's 800-735-0230. Let's listen now to, from the Pacifica Radio Archives, Kurt Vonnegut.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Kurt Vonnegut.
I left Indianapolis following puberty. When I went to high school in Indianapolis, I learned how to walk around looking tough, because everybody had to do that. And I went out to Indianapolis. I go out there occasionally, and they're still doing it. It's walking around looking very tough, because something might happen, you know? I was raised by a black maid by the name of Ida Young. I probably talked to her more than anybody, so whatever is nutty about me was nutty about her, too, I think, because I saw a lot more of her than I did of my parents. Now, here comes a rather intimate part, as I used to keep it a big secret, and I used to have awful guilt feelings. My mother was crazy toward the end. She was all right in the daytime unless you tried to take her picture. Where you get a bizarre reaction at night, she would really get wild, squaring people away and crashing around the house. That was barbiturates. These were supposed to tranquilize her, and they turned her brain to cobwebs. And I can't get mad at my mother because I pity her so much, is what she went through. I went and saw my parents' tombstone a couple of months ago, and I cried, and I hadn't cried for a long time, and what I was crying about was I wished they had been happier than they were, and I think this is probably a dumb thing to do. I think probably parents are much happier than the parents realize. I remember I asked my father what the happiest day of his marriage had been. This was after my mother died. And he said, well, they had an Oldsmobile, and they broke into the Indianapolis 500-mile speedway one Sunday and just drove around and around and around and around. I've heard that a writer is lucky because he cures himself every day with his work. What everybody is well advised to do is to not write about your own life. This is if you want to write fast. You will be writing about your own life anyway, but you won't know it. And the thing is, in order to sit alone and work all day long, you must be a terrible overreactor, and you're sitting there doing what paranoids do, is putting together clues, making them add up, you know, putting the fact that they put me into room 471, you know, and what does that mean and everything? Well, nothing means anything, except the artist makes his living by pretending, by putting it in a meaningful hole, though no such holes exist, and you need paranoia for energy, too. You must be terribly worried and secretly full of hate. I am now older than George Orwell when he died. I'll soon be older than Jack Kerouac when he died. Anyway, I've wondered why all these people kill themselves. And I think that writers, creative writers, are in the process of becoming. They are humanity becoming. It's like reaching into the mouth of a student and taking a hold of a piece of tape in the back of the mouth without getting bitten and seeing what the hell's written on it and then just keep pulling it out. And the person doesn't know what the hell it is. And I think it becomes an exhausting thing to do. That's about it. A lot of people decline to do it anymore. It becomes too unpleasant. I have written a story called The Big Space, and it's a, it's about this big. it's about the end of the world. All they're left are lampreys and human beings, and they're turning into man-eating lampreys. The space program now has built this enormous spaceship, and the hope is that human life will somewhere go on. It's got a big warhead on it filled with sperm, you see. And they're they are firing this thing out there, hoping it'll hit something, you see, and life... How important my books are, or anybody's books are, I don't know. I don't think they're terribly important. I think that they make people contented during the period they're reading them. And this is worth something, is to take care of somebody for a couple of hours. There will always be magic entertainers who will comfort people some during the Job story that all our lives are. For this reason, I honor my own profession. We are entertainers, don't do a whole lot, but something.
That's Kurt Vonnegut from the Pacifica Radio Archives, November 1970, speaking at NYU. Kurt Vonnegut, the novelist, author, of course, of Cat's Cradle, Breakfast of Champion. He says there that his novels take care of people for a couple of hours.
That's humble.
That is humble. We are thrilled to be featuring this interview with Kurt Vonnegut, along with interviews with John Coltrane, Dustin Hoffman, and a dozen others in the Pacifica Radio Archives History for the Holidays Fun Drive. I'm John Wiener. I'm joined here at the KPFK studios this hour by Mark Torres of the Archives and Alan Minsky, our program director at KPFK. And we need people to call us now at 800-735-0230. We have a $10,000 matching grant that we've just received. And Alan Minsky, who gave us the $10,000?
A former WBAI volunteer, a great artist in the 1960s. The name of the art troupe that she was associated with was, I can't remember, I'll get you that in a minute. And she also had a
Fluxus.
Fluxus, that's correct.
Good job.
That is correct. Mm. And then she had a show in London, and a very famous singer from Liverpool in a band called the Beatles saw the show, was absolutely mesmerized by it, and they fell in love, and they... yeah, had a life together. And Yoko Ono is the name of the person who was given a $10,000 matching pledge. So if you pledge now at any level, up to $10,000, your money is being doubled right now. We have only a handful of these Calendar of Revolts for the 2016 year. I'm holding one of them in my hand. And you can get those for a $50 pledge. It's like donating $100. We had the phone lines, a lot of people on them. We had the great clip from Kurt Vonnegut. You can get the Kurt Vonnegut as part of the $300 package. You could also get it when you pick up any program you want with the $100 pledge, because you get a program voucher. For $300, you get a 90-hour, 4-gigabyte USB drive, including the Kurt Vonnegut, the Dustin Hoffman, the John Coltrane, the complete collection of Martin Luther King's speeches, including the new material they've unearthed in the archives this past year from Dr. Martin Luther King. Incredible interviews with Studs Terkel. Did you know that these were in this year, John? It's incredible. It's Dorothy Parker, Zero Mostel, Leonard Bernstein, Daniel Ellsberg, Ralph Ellison. An interview with Terkel himself, Martin Luther King talking to Studs Terkel, Muhammad Ali.
Can I just say one thing about Terkel, the great Studs Terkel talking to Dr. Martin Luther King? Only place I've ever heard Dr. King talking about humor.
Yeah, that's right. It's very rare, but Studs Terkel, you know, asked him about humor, and Dr. King said, well, you gotta have a sense of humor, especially with all the horrible situation welling up all around you. You'd be a horrible person if you didn't have laughter in your life. And
you can say things with humor that you can't say in other ways.
That's true. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from 1964 with Studs Terkel. He just gets back from receiving his Nobel Peace Prize. You can take that tape away with our $100 voucher pack. You can pick any program from the Pacifica Radio Archives. It's a great gift because you don't have to know what the recipient of this gift really likes. We have everything. We have 55,000 selections. So you just give the gift of the voucher, and they can, at their leisure, pick anything from the archives. 1-800-735-0230. We've got three people on the line, and we need to fill them up. We've got 16 lines. I think we can do this, Alan, in 6 minutes.
800. Again, the number is 800-735-0230. 800-735-0230. You out there in Houston Metro, you in D.C., New York, Bay Area, down here in Southern California, maybe out in Fresno, maybe in Santa Barbara, call 800-735-0230. Preserve history for the $300 pledge. All that stuff I was talking about, you get, plus a bunch of other stuff, a DVD of Patti Smith on Democracy Now.
I want that.
It's history for the holidays. It's the gift of knowledge. How about hearing from somebody in New York? How about from Brooklyn?
Five people online.
Dave Gerlach is from Brooklyn. The recording that we just heard from Kurt Vonnegut, he was at NYU in November of 1970. So let's hear from New York, ladies and gentlemen, on our station WBAI.
800-735-0230. Support the Pacifica Radio Archives. It's our history. It's the record of our lives. It's the sound of our struggles, the voices of our dreams, the voices of our heroes. Nobody does it better. Nobody does it with greater care or greater professionalism than the Pacifica Radio Archive staff here in L.A. I see them every week. I know it's true.
800-735-0230. Again, on that $300 pledge, and this package is astonishing. This is the 90-hour collection. This is the stuff that they've really built up this year or just totally unearthed for new this year over the past year. Incredible material. Of course, it includes the King's speech in London, so they've included all of the King's speeches in the collection. The incredible comedy collection from Pacifica Radio. Groucho Marx, George Carlin, a good amount of George Carlin, by the way. Richard Pryor hosted a show at KPFA. Paul Krasner, Robin Williams, and two appearances, including a recent one here at KPFK on the David Feldman Show, not long before he died. And the entire Monty Python troupe, folks. Call 800-735-0230. Call now. Your money is doubled now because of a $10,000 matching pledge. We got to reach the $10,000 between now and the end of the fund drive.
And we got an hour to do it, and another person just joined the phone calls. Keep calling 1-800-735-0230. We need people to get to the phones and donate as generously as you can.
Hey, Mark, tell us about the holiday music special that's available only, uniquely, from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Jackson Browne, Louise Goffin. Goffin, that name rings a bell.
I know. So it rings a bell because her parents are two of the greatest songwriters in the history of songwriting. Jerry Goffin and Carol King were hammering out songs in one of those New York cubicles with a piano. She was coming up with the melodies. Jerry Goffin was coming up with the lyrics, and they together wrote some of the most amazing songs that you don't even know they wrote them. And then Carol King, of course, came out with Tapestry and re-recorded some of those songs herself. And Louise Goffin is a great singer-songwriter herself. And she donated a song.
And eating chicken soup with rice. So I think Maurice Sendak wrote those words.
800-735-0230. Please help the Pacifica Radio Archives. We have got reel-to-reel tapes that have got to be digitized before they fall apart. How many reel-to-reel tapes have you got upstairs,
we've
Mark?
We've got over 50,000 reels, and we've got 10,000 of them digitized and ready to go, but we've got 40,000 to go. We've got six people on the line. We need to fill it up to 16. 1-800-735-0230. 4 minutes left in the hour, and only 4 minutes and 1 hour left in the entire drive. So please get to the phone right now. Do not delay.
You know, I got an assist on one of these, as I think Mark knows, which is the Robert Frost.
Oh, very good.
Because I went up and I asked if there was Frost up there, and there was, but it wasn't digitized. And it's Robert Frost reading his own poetry. And that's, again, part of the – you get that for sure in the $300
We get that
collection.
Because when you saw it, mm-hmm. we digitized it and we put it into one of our From the Vault national programs.
Amazing stuff. And it gives you a sense of the wealth of material that's up there that's not yet digitized.
Yeah.
It has to be digitized, folks. There is so many jewels up there in the Pacifica Radio Archives. Call 800-735- 735-0230. And remember, your money is as good as doubled, folks. Doubled because of a $10,000 matching fund from really one of the great advocates for peace and art and really just humanity, yeah. Yoko Ono, has donated a $10,000 matching pledge. We got to match it between now and the end of the archive. So call 800-735-0230, 800-735-0230.
I want to thank everybody for listening. Thanks to Yoko Ono, our matching pledge of $10,000. Yoko has been very important to Pacifica since the beginning. Thanks to everybody who called this hour, and thanks to Mark Torres and Alan Minsky. I'm John Wiener. Stay tuned for another hour of special broadcasting, the last hour of the Pacifica Radio Archives History for the Holidays Fund Drive, hosted by Ian Masters, coming up next right here on the Pacifica Radio Network.
You're listening to the 14th Annual Pacifica Radio Archives History for the Holidays Fun Drive broadcast, heard in a rare Pacifica simulcast on all five Pacifica stations. KPFA 94.1 FM Berkeley, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM North San Diego, 99.5 FM Ridgecrest, KPFT 90.1 Houston, Texas, WBAI 99.5 FM New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM Washington, D.C. Your donation today helps us rescue our history before it's lost. For a donation of $50, we'll send you, as our gift, our brand new Music for the Holidays benefit album, a compilation of 10 holiday songs donated by artists including Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Jackson Browne, Holly Near, Perla Bataya, Louise Goffin, Gabby Moreno, Elvis, David Garza, Leftover Cuties, The New Recessionaires, Quetzal, Nancy Sanchez, and more. Call 1-800-735-0230 to pledge your support for this endangered American treasure, or go online at supportpra.org.
And if there's any doubt in your mind, you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the creation of a new intelligence agency, not by the U.S. government, but by Charles and David Koch of the Koch brothers, who have hired a competitive intelligence team of 25, including one former CIA analyst, to thwart liberal groups and activists. Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico and author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking of American Politics, joins us. He broke the story in Politico, and we will discuss his latest article, The Koch Intelligence Agency, and the efforts by the billionaire brothers to spy on Democrats while rooting out moles within their own ranks. Then we will speak with Christopher Swift, a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the University of Virginia Center for National Security Law. He's the author of The Fighting Vanguard, Local Insurgencies in the Global Jihad, and we will discuss whether the West is giving Daesh, the Islamic State, exactly what they want with the nativist response to the shutting the door on Syrian refugees, which reinforces the clash of civilizations model that Daesh is trying to inflame. Then finally, we'll go to Geneva, Switzerland, and speak with Joel Millman, the press officer for the International Organization of Migration, who previously worked as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering immigration and human trafficking. We'll discuss how much attitudes in Europe have changed towards the influx of refugees from Syria since the massacres in Paris. And joining us now is Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign trail, traveling during the 2008 race with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. He's the author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking of American Politics. And his latest article at Politico is The Koch Intelligence Agency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Vogel.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Ian.
Well, Ken, I'm amazed by your article and what you've uncovered here. And, you know, it's one thing to learn that the United States government has created a new intelligence agency, because after all, we've got an alphabet soup of about 16 intelligence agencies in the government in Washington, D.C. But here we have, you've uncovered the fact that Charles and David Koch of the Koch brothers have hired a competitive intelligence team of 25, including one former CIA analyst, and I take it their marching orders are to thwart liberal groups and activists.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. They are attempting to essentially do surveillance and gather intelligence on what the professional left is doing. We talk about the professional left being unions, environmental groups, democratic campaigns, super PACs, party committees. And the reason why they're doing this is because, of course, they've been investing increasingly in politics over the last several years. And after the 2012 presidential campaign, during which they spent a ton of money, more than $400 million, it was really like their coming out party into big money, overt big money politics. And they didn't get a whole lot for that. In fact, Barack Obama was reelected president. Senate stayed in Democratic hands, and they were disappointed, and they did a forensic audit to determine sort of what went wrong and how they could spend their money more efficiently. And one of the key findings was that the left had just outmaneuvered them, both on the ground in terms of organizing and the ad wars, in terms of data. And they wanted to both build up their own capabilities so that they could compete with what the left was doing, or what they thought that the left was doing, in a more efficient way. But also they wanted to figure out what the left was doing and be able to track it in real time so that they could respond in real time. The idea being that if they found out that a union was organizing or was registering voters or doing get-out-the-vote work in a particular district that they had an interest in, well, they would need to counter that. They would need to send their own ground forces to go and do organizing to offset what the liberals are doing, at least rally their base to come out and vote. And how would you do that? How would you be able to effectively direct your resources to counter what the left is doing if you don't know what the left is doing? That's the idea behind this competitive intelligence group.
Yeah, but Kenneth Vogel, when you say the professional left, it almost sounds like an oxymoron or the old joke by Will Rogers, I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some of that, although one of the main things, one of the main reasons why the Kochs sort of got involved in politics in the first place, or where they saw their potential niche with some of the ground organizing that they were doing, where the right has really just not been as efficient as the left and has not spent as much money as the left in getting out the vote, doing door-to-door retail politicking. That in large part has to do with the unions. Organized labor has traditionally done a very good job of rallying its members and investing in this type of activity. But then also there is sort of more of an activist base on the left, or has been, around some of the key causes that animate the left, including abortion rights, including environmental protection and fighting climate change, than there has been on the right. And so the Kochs essentially tried to build from whole cloth, their political network did, sort of a commensurate army of activists who would go out and do this type of thing. And that's expensive, and they've invested a lot of money in doing it. So far, the results are kind of mixed. They do very well, as does the right as a whole in the Republican Party, in off-year elections, the midterm elections. But when the turnout is very high and the Democratic and liberal groups really kick into gear with some of this ground organizing, the right and the Kochs and the Republican Party have not done as well.
So would they be aware of the fact that perhaps people that are being paid by them on the right are not necessarily as dedicated activists as the people on the left who are not being paid, but who are motivated by the very issues that you pointed out, not the least of which would be the Koch brothers themselves? I mean, you know, the Democrats in many ways run against the Koch brothers. Bernie Sanders is running against the Koch brothers.
Yeah, that's right, and I think that they're aware of that. I think that actually bothers them, and they've invested a good bit of money in recent years in a PR campaign to try to burnish their image a little bit and show that they're not entirely the stereotype that the left sort of makes them out to be. That is that, you know, this idea that they're spending all this money simply to pad their bottom line and to elect politicians who they think are going to be better for them on taxes and environmental regulation and other issues. You know, there may be some of that, but certainly their activism and involvement in politics and public policy in recent years has focused on a number of issues where there's very little to no bottom line impact for them, such as criminal justice reform and fighting the export-import bank. So they've tried to get that message out there. On your question as to whether the left is more motivated and the ground troops and activists on the left are simply more motivated because they care more passionately about these set of issues, I think there has been some of that. But I think that in 2009 and 2010, with the rise of the Tea Party protest movement, we did see a real grassroots base of legit activists, grassroots activists, who were rising up. And what the Kochs did so effectively, you know, there's some, I think there's a tendency on the left to see the Tea Party as like totally astroturf and just bought and paid for by the Kochs and other wealthy donors. And that overlooks the very real motivations that these activists had to get involved in the first place. It doesn't, however, necessarily mean that the Kochs and the groups that they had set up and the groups that other wealthy conservatives and conservative foundations had set up didn't work to harness that energy and to give those activists resources and platforms to get and stay involved. So there's a little bit of an oversimplification by the left on both the motivations of the Kochs and the caricature of the Kochs, and then also the idea that the Tea Party was sort of astroturf as opposed to legitimately grassroots. Those are both like very nuanced calculations and assessments of people's motivations that I don't think can or should be painted with too broad a brush.
And again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Vogel, who's the chief investigative reporter for Politico. He tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence, and he's the author of Big Money, $2.5 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. And his latest article at Politico is The Koch Intelligence Agency. So in many ways, it would seem from your article, Ken, that the competitive intelligence team that the Kochs have set up also is as much engaged in intelligence as it is in counterintelligence. They apparently are pretty paranoid by leaks and moles. And a friend of mine, Lauren Windsor, was able to infiltrate their meeting down in Orange County recently and actually get recordings inside the secret conclave of millionaires and billionaires over a weekend at a luxury resort where they had all kinds of workshops, including one that sort of basically talks about the need for intelligence. And apparently they, according to your article, they've, sleuthed on a Greenpeace activist, and they're all the time looking for moles because clearly somebody got inside those conclaves and recorded what happened.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I cite those recordings and transcripts thereof in the story. And in fact, I've used those recordings in other stories as well because they are a treasure trove of information about how these folks and their donors talk when they don't think that anyone is listening. But the fact that there are people who are so intent on recording this, and as you put it, like with Bernie Sanders or American Bridge, the David Brock run group, running against the Koch brothers, it shows that, in fact, there is this interest in getting inside the operation and pulling back the curtain. And so it sort of makes sense that they would be very deliberative. You use the word paranoid. I wouldn't use that word, but very deliberative about attempting to assess and root out these potential leaks and threats because they're real.
So, but what is also real, clearly, Ken, is that there are people on the inside who do leak this. You don't get into those Koch conclaves unless you're a millionaire or a billionaire, as far as I know.
Right. Well, I've been inside, but not for long. You're right. Keep a pretty close eye out. And so that's right, and that's also part of it, is to figure out, you know, what people inside are doing, because, you know, it's, as is the case with the left and major liberal groups and political parties and campaigns, you know, there are people who talk to the press, and it is our job in the press to get those people to talk to us and to continue to talk to us and hopefully leak us all kinds of great documents and details and stuff like that. And it is the job of those entities to be on the lookout for those types of things and try to mitigate those risks. So some of this, you know, what is striking about some of this to me, a couple of things that are very striking. One of them is, like, this is pretty standard practice in corporate America, and the Kochs have really gone to great lengths to try to apply corporate management techniques and corporate structures to their political activity and the political activity of the donors who they convene twice a year at these seminars that you alluded to. So this in some ways is, I think, the Competitive Intelligence Unit, the focus on the investment in it, stems from that, the desire to apply corporate structures to political work. And so that's a little bit new. There are certainly opposition research groups and certainly a constant effort to sleuth out leakers and moles. But I think, like, the way that they're doing this is new and is unique. The second thing that I would say that struck me in writing this story was that